Good morning. Welcome back to Story Hodge. I'm Jennifer Robinson, and today I am in Florida with my friend Hannah.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So we're doing sort of a ladies who breakfast this morning. Hannah and I are, and Molly, we're with her sister Molly, but she's not mic'd up, so we're going to try to catch everything, but... So we're doing coffee, and we're doing banana slices and toast with eggs and avocado.
Yeah.
That Hannah prepared. Thank you so much, Hannah.
Anytime.
Okay, so this is just like a short stopover trip. I just came in last night because Hannah and Molly, you guys are here for a family wedding party stuff.
Yes, true. Our little brother is getting married.
Or got married.
Got married, past tense. We're having another party to celebrate in Florida. So the gift that keeps on giving, really.
That's so exciting. So the wedding was in Minnesota.
Michigan. Close.
Whoops. So all the M's.
So Midwestern M's.
And then, three of us know each other from Iraq.
True.
In 2014.
Yes.
But you guys, I arrived in January. When were you there?
I was there from before you arrived, just starting in October. So I was there from October to January, and then you came, and we were colleagues and roommates.
And roommates, housemates. Yes, that was lovely. So we do have, when I think of roommates, I think of the cat story, the little kitten that Hannah adopted and then changed her mind about within hours.
It was my attempt to be nurturing while living on the field, take care of something that breathes. But it didn't go very well. And particularly one morning, I was cooking breakfast and the little rat jumped up and like, grabbed onto my yoga pants with his claws, and I was so mad. And then I went about cooking, like kind of kicked him across the room gently. It wasn't too brutal.
This will come back to action.
Went about cooking my breakfast and realized like about 20 minutes later that there was meowing coming from a place I couldn't find. Realized he had jumped into the refrigerator when I'd opened it. So that's why I decided I was an unfit animal caregiver and I gave him back.
That's not how I remember that. I feel like within hours, the night of, it was like, no, this isn't going to happen.
Oh yeah, I hated him the whole time.
Yeah.
But it was when I locked him in the refrigerator accident.
Okay.
That I just realized I was unfit in the role.
But I love the fact that like when you had Facebook, which you don't now, there was pictures of kittens like everywhere as if you like them.
I was trying so
What
hard.
Is this? Who is this person? I don't know.
I've been trying to like nurture a different side and it doesn't really work.
Well, good. E for effort or A for effort? What do you get for effort?
I'll just head back to the field and be done with that kind of thing.
Okay, so what were we doing in Iraq? You did something. I didn't do much. That first 6 months, let me clarify.
Okay, first 6 months. So you're both working, mainly doing women's livelihood projects. We're doing a sewing project in one of the Syrian refugee camps in Kurdistan.
But it was under the label of child protection.
Yes, we were incognito, child protection. There's a big territorial war, you know? We just had to pick what we could get.
I love it. Yeah, so basically there was this camp in Sulaymaniyah with the Syrian refugees and Samaritan's Purse. You did set up a playground for the child-friendly space that was being run by another organization called STEP. So there was all of that aspect to it, but then Samaritan's Purse also had a space in the camp, a tent, and they had set up this sewing project, and it was like sewing clothing for women and children, and then distributing those clothing as well.
Yes.
Plus we got to participate in the shoebox,
yes.
Samaritan's Purse shoebox distribution.
It's true.
Which was very exciting.
And then we expanded the sewing project because we had this really nice space that was available. And
we did the
used.
Persian
Zumba. Zumba classes.
Zumba was amazing. It's like, I remember talking about it for like a long time.
And being me
like,
too.
We have to do this and not thinking we're actually going to teach Zumba in the camp. But just tried it. It worked out great.
And it's to date my favorite thing I've ever done, I think.
Me too. Everywhere I went after that, I tried to tell people, like, guys, this works. Nobody's doing it.
People, to exercise.
Yeah. It was like so fun and a happy dance. And
yeah.
I wonder if they kept doing it, if anybody did.
I don't know. I'd love to know.
I would too. I miss those guys. I miss that original group of people, because that was where we actually got to be friendly and connect. Whereas like my job after that, it was more managerial and meetings with the people and not laughter, which is quite different.
Yeah.
Sad.
And being present like on a normal like day-to-day basis as opposed to just visiting.
Oh, those are good days. They were good days. Fun days too. Lots of good memories outside of work too.
Yeah, for sure.
So, oh, remember that time we found the landmine? That's a good story.
Yes, that was.
We were hiking in Malwat. I don't think Molly was with us. Was she with us?
I don't think so.
So we were with me and you and Dave and Stacy, some people from another NGO or organization. And Malwat is a beautiful, beautiful lake area that doesn't really have a lot of visitors to it. So we were going to go swimming. You know, we could wear our bathing suits and where we couldn't do that anywhere else where people would be around.
Yeah, it's really secluded. You'd like drive up and then kind of hike down this ravine, like into the riverbed that goes along between the mountains. So it was this beautiful secret place we would go to.
So we went on this like path and these big giant rocks were sort of hopping from one boulder to another boulder.
Yeah.
Right?
Like in the river, yeah.
In the river. And so we're passing all along the way, barbed wire, helmets that are all rusted out, all this military paraphernalia.
Yeah. And at one point during this same hike, I'm on what I think is like a rock or a boulder. And it actually was an old like military tank. I realized it had like bolts in it and stuff.
What?
Yeah. This might have been the time before, but it was like, I thought it was just a regular boulder.
Oh, yes, and I'm
like,
because when we went, it was actually covered by the water.
Yes.
And we could just see the top of it. Mm-hmm. And I kept saying, no, that's a waterfall. But it was like a full-on tank.
Yeah.
So you had gone the time prior, and you were walking on it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's crazy. So what happened was, is we got to sort of as far as we could go on that trail. The trail ended. I think there was like two of us on the others on this at the ending point and like two that were still coming behind, and you had to like walk under a boulder, so there's like a little boulder bridge, and Dave was, I think it was Dave, he was like, hey guys, I think there's an anti-personnel mine here. And so we all came back and of course had to look at it and like get our faces real close.
no I heard mine, got close enough to see it. And then while you guys were talking about building the appropriate rock structure around...
That was me.
That was good. That was wise, you know, to warn people who were coming later. But I decided, no, thank you. And I was probably back at, like, the car by the time you guys built that rock structure.
Well, we didn't build the rock structure. We failed. But I have to mention that I just squirted egg juice all over my hand and the table. But yeah, so I say to Dave, I think we're supposed to, you know, put white rocks around it or something in a circle. That's what I had said because I couldn't really remember my training. And then as I pondered it a little bit more, I just thought, you know what, I don't think this is the right course of action. Seems a little too dangerous to me.
Let's just throw rocks as close as we can to the water.
Right. Yeah. So then we just like abandoned it and like went back and... forgot about it, actually. I don't think we reported it as we should have.
And this is the part of the story where we admit our past failures.
Right. Whoops.
But what's going to Malwa? Beware.
I mean, the good news is I think it's sort of out of the way.
That's true. Very few people found that place.
Yeah. So now you are just home from Greece.
Yes. I'm home visiting, but... currently working in Greece, in the north of the country, close to the border with Macedonia, with the refugees that came across and lost, 9 months now.
Mm-hmm.
Into Greece. That's where I am, and I'll be returning to in a few weeks.
How long have you worked there?
I started in October of last year. It's been about 9 months now.
when you first arrived, what was the situation?
So when I first arrived, it was during the time when we were having thousands of arrivals per day to the islands. So I was posted on one of the islands, working alongside the other NGOs.
By the way, there'll be some background noises. We have children waking up. Nieces and nephews will be joining us shortly.
It was a family affair.
Yes, the whole family visiting. Mm-hmm. So
there's a lot of arrivals to the islands at that point. So we were setting up like reception points and doing water and sanitation and distribution of NFIs, etc. on the islands.
And I did see a video which you are starring in.
I really try to get this out there.
So a video, Samaritan's Purse put out a video, I think.
Yes, they did.
The work that you guys were doing. So you were actually sometimes on the shores helping boats come in, right?
Yeah, in the very beginning, when it's kind of like all the NGOs, volunteer groups kind of descended on the island when everything was just at its height of arrivals. And so it was that time of figuring out like what we were going to do and where the gaps were that we would fill. And so in the meantime, we did like stand on the shore and like greet the boats in some of the areas that were harder to get to and would provide them with support until they were able to get to one of the transit centers. So
what was that like? Was it like you'd get a phone call, somebody would say a boat is coming in, you get in your car, you drive down the can?
It was more like we would just kind of post like ourselves or teams like on the shore in this one particularly difficult area to reach. It was just really rocky, and after you landed, it was really steep, kind of ravine up to the main highway, and people just didn't know where to go. And so we would just kind of be present on the beach and wait for the boats to come in. And you know, sometimes there'd be 9 or 10 within an hour. So it was more like waving them in to safe spots to offload. And it was interesting. Some of the boats, people were so like relieved to have made it safely, and they were like really joyful, and they'd jump off, and like even before there was like a song and dance that
would
erupt.
It was like a celebratory mood.
Yeah, or they would, you know, pray to thank God that they'd made it safely. And then other times it was so clear that it had been a really traumatic experience, and it was like very somber and really full of fear, like just so anxious to get off of the boats and onto the land. It was a very like intense time.
Yeah, and you would have seen like babies, children.
Yeah, I mean the boats were filled with families. I mean, like so many children. And it was interesting the way that a lot of times like the media would portray like these boats of young men. But the interesting thing was that a lot of times, yes, on the outer areas of the boats there were men, but it's because the women and children were on the inside. So like as the men would hop out the front, they would be passing up the women and the children, like and so yeah,
it was like just a human chain.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a lot of like sensationalism surrounding all that was happening.
And we know a friend of ours that we met in Sulaimania who was about probably 13 when we worked in that camp. And he was our friend because he wanted to learn English so badly and just a fantastic kid.
Yeah.
Who greeted us every time we drove in and just it was so great. And then one day on Facebook I get a message, "Hey Jennifer, I'm in Germany now." And so I think he's probably like 15 now.
Yeah.
Made the journey himself by boat, went through Greece. I don't think you saw him, but
I didn't, no.
But he did it all. So he was a young man, but he's like if you think about it, he's like a 14, 15-year-old kid by himself. And, you know, he's a kid. He's just a kid. I don't know any other way to say it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I talk to him too sometimes, and he's living in a home for unaccompanied minors in Germany and learning German.
And
he's like, so excited about the opportunity to be in Europe and to be out of the camp that he was living in.
Right.
With really like no prospects for like what does life look like growing up in a refugee camp, and where there was school available, but what was he going to do in 10 years?
And I mean, in my opinion, he's the best of the best, right? Like, it truly is. And if anybody deserves a better opportunity, it's and we'll make the most of it.
Yeah,
for it's sure. him
for sure.
But yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy when there's a face and it's a person that you know and that you love and that you know their story and they're mm-hmm. not just a number. They're not just one of a group. They're not one of thousands. They're right. real people. And even for us, I think it really helps to have to know that because it changes our attitudes and how we think about what we do.
For sure. And even there's...
How are you?
I'm good.
Hey, Dad.
How are you? Nice to meet you.
Yes.
This is my friend Jen.
Okay. It's very much a family affair in this household.
Hannah, I'm just worried about this egg I got on your table.
Oh, don't worry about it.
There's no napkin.
Yeah, I'll get it later.
Okay.
So you didn't, we'll just go with it.
Can we call Molly?
It's okay.
Okay.
Okay, so
where we were.
So well, we were just talking about Greece and, you know, putting the faces and knowing yes. the people and
yeah,
and wanting to be able to express that. I know I want it's something I want to express to the rest of the world, to my friends, to say, hey guys, you know, these are real people and their stories matter right. and
yeah, yeah. like normal. Families
yeah.
that if any of us were in the same position, like we would be pursuing peace and safety and the opportunity for our kids to go to school.
Yeah.
Like it's been years since so many of these children have right. been like in any sort of formal education and so many of them can't read and can't write and
yeah.
you know, like they're literally mm-hmm. stranded in countries around the Middle East and in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. I'm just passionate about the fact that we should be doing what we can.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and they're lovely people. Lovely people.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So what is your work now then?
Yeah, so now I've transitioned into the north of Greece. Yeah, we were working in more of the informal camps.
So what is what is northern Greece? Is that yeah. like Athens area?
No,
or?
So northern Greece is like is north of Thessaloniki, so literally on the border of Macedonia and Greece.
Okay.
We live in a tiny little town. Our office is in a small town in the north where a lot of camps were set up when the border was, were closed. So when the Macedonian and Greek border closed, everybody just kind of squatted where they were. Like,
right,
along
like
the
by
journey.
That fence, what we would yeah. have seen on the news.
Right, yeah. So Idomeni was the camp that was all over the news. And that was the main one that we were working in. So we were doing mainly food distribution in that camp. But now, like over the last month, a lot of the, or really all now, of the informal camps have closed and everyone's gone to the government-run camps where they'll begin the registration process of registering and then applying for asylum within Greece.
Those camps... They were like squatter camps? Or how did they differ from what, like a typical camp that we would have seen in Kurdistan?
Yeah, they were, yeah. It was, conditions were really rough, and that was mainly because when the border closed, there's just like a back trailing of, on the actual border, on the train station there, is where the largest camp was set up. So at one point it had about 17,000 people just literally on the train tracks, and in the surrounding farmlands.
And with like their own tents that they yeah. that they bought from like a camping store or...
And a lot that had been like distributed by different groups.
Okay.
Or they...
But they weren't set up with like a pattern or,
oh, no.
you know...
It looked like a massive just camping site where yeah. everybody had different colored, differently set up tents.
And what about toilets?
So there were some organizations working there that had provided that kind of thing, but obviously the ratio of person to toilet or sink or shower was terrible. It wasn't nearly enough for the number of people living in that area, and even things like drainage, it would rain one day and it would just kind of be like ponds everywhere. But people wanted to stay there because they were hopeful that the border would open.
Yeah.
And so they didn't want to come back south, you know, to retrace their steps to go to any other camp because they were just always hopeful that they'd be able to move on Which as the months progressed, they recognized that that wasn't going to be the case.
Is that when a lot of like anger was built and you saw people maybe like cutting fences? Is that where you were?
Yeah, I think there was a lot of lack of information and a lot of wrong information disseminated as well. And so
when you say wrong information was disseminated, is that from like rumors that people were spreading amongst the community, or was it from the government side, or like?
Yeah, I think there was definitely like the more like younger, more passionate refugees who saw this as kind of like a huge statement, and understandably they felt that if they left that hotspot in that area, that they would just be forgotten, that they would blend into these normal camps and no one would remember that there are so many thousands of refugees still in Greece. And so it was like it was this place to make a statement about what was happening to them. And so
because they were so visible.
Right. They were blocking the train between Greece and Macedonia. Like that track no longer ran. And so a lot of times some of them like would incite like riots. They would try to rush the fence, or they would rush the police buses, or they would just cut the wires. And a lot of times then like the Macedonian police would respond. And that's the images that we saw from the news of the tear gas and the rubber bullets. Yeah. And so often like families were caught in that crossfire because it was a small group. Right. Of people that were the ones pushing that forward, and then you could see the families kind of like running back away from
and
that.
Being scared. Yeah, probably, right?
For sure. And even as going as far as I don't know exactly who like disseminated this information, but one day they were telling everyone and passing out flyers that the borders were going to open.
Somebody was actually passing out flyers.
Yes, and so families, of course, they packed up and they like. Came to the fence, and the police were all obviously.
What are you doing here? Right?
Like, what's happening? Like, yeah. And then it was just that was probably one of the worst days with the way that the police had to respond. But then there were families that were like up in that front line, having no intention of being violent,
right?
But being just kind of caught in the crossfire.
It makes me like, I still do get really emotional. It's not like you get hardened, right?
Right.
Like, but. To imagine a family who's packed up their stuff that got the news that the border is going to open and they're so happy and they have their babies in their arms and their toddler standing next to them and they're ready to go only to find out it was a rumor and you know, it's not going to happen. And on top of that, there's all this violence and making you feel not wanted.
Yeah.
It's heartbreaking.
Yeah. Well, it really is. There's definitely just a sense of like hopelessness that I think characterizes this situation currently, as opposed to like this surging forward, like in the fall of excitement, really.
Yeah.
Like borders were open and the journey was hard and long, but it had this end goal.
Yeah, the reward.
Right, of hopefully like safety and peace and prosperity, like was kind of the dream. And now there's just so much uncertainty, even as that camp we're talking about was emptied and everyone was taken to informal camps. I was leaving the camp on the last day, and they were asking one of our translators, where are we going? Are we being sent back to Turkey? Where are we headed on this bus that we're about to be boarding? And that was just heartbreaking, even there, like no control over what happens to you. No information.
Right.
Like, how terrifying.
Well, I mean, this isn't maybe your area, but why do you think there's a lack of information? Because I know that in the work that we do, every agency has like an information management officer, like communications, communicating with communities is a thing. So, and I know like, I think is it the Red Cross, Red Crescent Society? I think that they had a large information campaign.
Yeah.
But what did it actually look like on the ground?
I mean, there were times, and I think especially when the route was open, where there was just a better job of, at these points of transit, providing information about this is where you are, this is what comes next, and this is what you can expect. But I think when these informal camps were set up, and for obvious reasons, the government didn't want them to exist. And even a lot of the NGO community recognized that these were not safe good places for people to be. And so they were never set up properly. Like there was never, and there was
a place. So then if you don't set up something formally, then you don't technically have information to share about it.
There was so much like nuance even in the way it was communicated about among even us, among NGO workers and the different echelons of government and different organizations. So it was just shrouded in a lot of mystery, I guess, in some ways, a lot of uncertainty. It was hard to get straight answers, even for like me asking questions. And there was a space in the camp where they could go and get information. But it wasn't information about something like this move.
So this isn't us talking about, you know, anything from, we're not talking from the point of view of anything official. This is just how it was. And it just shows the complexity of the environment that we work in and that the refugees have to navigate as well. It is so complex and... Yeah.
And at the same time, it's an environment where it's easy to point fingers and to say that this is being done poorly or, you know, you could blame any, like you could blame NGOs, you could blame the government, you could blame anyone you want, really. But there isn't precedent for this. Like this is, it's unbelievable that in 2016 we have refugee camps all over Europe. And in Greece. And so... Like, I do think it's important to recognize there's complexities and things that we don't understand. Or that we're not, like, conversations we're not involved in. And but hopefully, like, we're involved in, like, making the current situation to the degree that we can better.
Make it better. I know from a camp management perspective, I haven't worked in Greece, but I do know that there were working groups of people who were trying to rethink how do we apply what we know from other places, other experiences, and how do we rewrite our books? How do we rewrite our manuals? How do we do this quickly in a way that we have some guidelines for this particular response, you know?
In a brand new context.
But it also takes time, you know, it takes time to get that out and get it agreed upon by everyone and then teach people that. You know, it's not like you can just write something and then everybody knows what it is, but you've got to disseminate that even to your workers.
It's definitely like playing catch up while the situation continues and changes. But yeah, it's unlike anywhere I've worked before. Sure.
So when I first met you, Hannah, it was like your first mission, I think, and then so now you're a couple years in. Did you go to Nepal too?
No.
Okay.
I took a break to bake the bread that you're currently eating.
Oh, nice. So then, okay. Do you see hope for the Greece situation? And then, what do you think is coming next in your future? Those are my
big questions for 7:30 breakfast. I think I do see hope in the sense that things are calming and settling, but at the same time, like, you almost see people, like, settling into a place they don't want to be, but at the same time, like, structures are being put in place, like, people are being registered, and their, like, applications for asylum will be processed, and I think it may not be what they hoped for, but based on the current situation, that's best case right now. Like, they can't continue their journey, but there's forward movement there. Even though that it may be, we're kind of looking at probably years of the current situation. So I think now there's the opportunity to provide better support within those camps while they're in Greece living in this situation. So yeah, like I do think there's hope there that there can be like better support and better services and even psychosocial support and the kind of different programs that we did even in Iraq, you know, where like quality of life is improved.
That's so important.
As the emergency situation kind of, it changes. It's not so much an emergency, it's kind of life as of right now, which obviously has the potential to change again.
It's a very dynamic situation.
But I hope to see just a lot more of that type of support and services provided in the camps. And I always think like that's a hopeful, like, forward-moving thing as people are able to look ahead and almost probably, again, to, like, find something new to hope for. Yeah. So I think that's definitely the direction I hope that we're going.
Yeah. And like we say, we always hope that we work ourselves out of a job, right?
Exactly.
Like you hope that things stabilize.
Right. And leaders within their own community,
right,
like, are the ones facilitating those things. So yeah. And for me, like, I will head back to Greece. I've kind of done Greece in phases. It was like the, you know, arrivals on the island phase, and then it was just the tumultuous north, and as things shifted from informal to formal camps. And now, like, I definitely feel a need to go back and to see through this next transition.
Phase, yeah.
And so I'll head back there for an undetermined amount of time. And following that, like, who knows?
Well, I'm hoping that you get a little extra time off so that you can hang out with me a little bit longer while I drive around Florida.
Yeah, as Trin goes on her adventures.
But yeah, there's always great times ahead, like we hope for. So, okay, my final question, I had it on the tip of my tongue. The final question is, I have no big finish, no big ending.
It's okay.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Hannah, for letting me off the hook. Okay. Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah. Thanks for talking for breakfast and for this fun conversation.
I'm honored that our house was a stop on the story hatch.
For sure.
I expect great things.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, for those of you listening out there, this is Jennifer signing off. And again, you can always find me on iTunes, Story Hodge. I think you can still look up Voices from the Road or Stories from the Road. But find me and subscribe, follow, so you can hear more podcasts like this one. Also on Google Play Music. Thanks. Till next time.